One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning into the show. Today I've got a very special guest, but before I actually even get into that, I just wanted to give like a little prelude to everything. And that is to anyone who's listening that's kind of into podcasts and that kind of thing. I started this maybe 20 or so episodes ago with a USB microphone, and I've somehow found myself in a really swanky studio talking to Tim, who is the CEO at DNAD. So just to say, kind of get started with you, with if you really want to do this kind of thing, because, you never know what might happen. As Stephen Johnson calls it, the adjacent possible. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. I know you said you read a lot of books.
I'm familiar with Stephen. He's a good guy, yeah. I didn't know he'd said that, though.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start off by asking what your story is, Tim. So how did you end up becoming the CEO of the UK's leading awards organisation?
Goodness. It depends how far back you want to go there, Ricky. I read English, actually, at Cambridge, at a time when it was a lot easier to get in than it is now, trust me. And I became a father while I was still at university. And what I really wanted to do was journalism, and which is still actually the thing that gives me the most satisfaction, writing something that's, you know, people like. So I went into advertising because I needed to be in London because of those circumstances, and I needed to earn some money. And I spent the next 40 years doing it. So there you go.
So you think that's how you ended up?
Well, that's how I ended up in advertising. And I stayed in it because it was enjoyable. And every time I thought about doing something else, you sort of realise you were trapped by the salary and quite enjoying it, really enjoying it. And then I sort of fell out of love in the end with running ad agencies and agency networks, which I'd been lucky enough to do. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do, not being qualified for very much except advertising by that stage. This is like 7 years ago. And the DNAD job sort of fell into my lap. A good friend of mine was CEO of DNAD, my predecessor, also called Tim. And his family circumstances took him off to Ireland, and he got me onto the board as a trustee. And they asked me if I wanted to do the job. And
there
I said,
go.
Yeah, I really do want to do it, actually. And it's been 6.5 years, been really good fun.
So I suspect most people will already know what DNAD is, but just for anyone who's listening that doesn't, kind of what is DNAD's kind of modus operandi? Is that the right phrase? I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Absolutely. Well, it's actually a creative education charity supported in the main by a highly prestigious global advertising and design awards show. So that's not the only thing we do by any means. We're actually a little bit bigger than most people think we'll be. So like 60 or 70 people now. And we, as well as running the award show, which is complicated and demanding, we run another award show called DNAD Impact in the States, which we could talk more about. Maybe we train people. We're a membership organization. We put on events and exhibitions. So we have sort of 5 or 6 lines of business, but the awards part of it is by far the most significant. With the money that we earn, and we make, you know, decent profits, surpluses, as we call them in the, in the charity world, we run the New Blood program. We run a number of events and programs that are designed to help supremely talented young people, in the main young people, into the professional industries. That's right. What we do. So, not very much in a nutshell, but that's what we do.
No, that pretty well sums it up. As I say, I'm sure most people will be familiar with that anyway. As I kind of pre-warned you prior to this, I've got a few tough questions for you, and I'm going to throw you in at the deep end. So I want to know why people should spend their life working in advertising.
A very good question. So the reason it's mostly... So here's one definition of advertising, right? Selling shit to people who can't afford it paid for with money they don't really have to impress people who don't care. And the advertising industry is at least complicit in some of the problems that afflict society today, because it does sell people things they don't need and has in the past been too defensive of its role in selling, you know, processed foods and fizzy drinks and you know, going further back, cigarettes and so on. The defence of which is usually, well, if it's legal to sell it, you know, it should be legal to advertise it. And I'm not sure that, I think it's sometimes more complicated than that. The reason why, there are lots of reasons, but there are some main reasons why it's a satisfying and worthwhile thing to do now. One of the things is that the advertising industry is in a great position to help the client community do well by doing good, in Lord Leverhulme's great phrase back at the end of the 19th century. And to do that, the industry needs to discover kind of new tools, new languages, new strategies, new ways of approaching business problems to help the client community do the right thing. And as I say, to prosper by doing that right thing. And the internet and, you know, a lot of other things that have come along with the internet give consumers the right to scrutinize the behavior of the people they're buying stuff from, and increasingly divert away from that if they're not satisfied with that company's behavior. The recent example of United Airlines dragging a passenger off a plane and its share price falling by 15% is a very potent example of that. It happened yesterday. So companies punish people punish companies that don't do the right thing. Agencies have to lead that charge.
So do you think it's up to agencies to go after clients that they believe in?
I think not every client can have a sort of purpose beyond profit that is holy and sanctified and all the rest of it. You know, it depends what you make and do. But all companies can behave ethically. And I think the advertising industry has a responsibility to show client companies how they can prosper and possibly not to work with them if they refuse to behave in an ethical way. That's one thing. So there's some satisfaction, I think, in pursuing those purposeful agendas. And Unilever's growth plan is called the Plan for Sustainable Living, lest we forget. You know, the second biggest advertising spender in the world is actually trying to do the right thing.
Is that people just trying to jump on the bandwagon of that, or is it real?
Even greenwash is a step in the right direction.
Right.
Because at least it's being considered at some level. And certainly Unilever and Procter & Gamble and many, many other big brand-owning companies' behaviour is not greenwash. They mean what they say. The second thing is that we in the business, and I absolutely include the design community in this, who've been thinking about this shit for longer than the advertising community, in truth, we have the skills that the world needs, because what we have to affect is behaviour change in the broadest possible sense. And we're the people that know how to do that, even if it's by product B as opposed to product A. And putting those skills to work, you know, in the service of society, I think is a very exciting thing. And increasingly, even, you know, not even, big technology companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and so on actually require their employees to do some purposeful work alongside their professional work. And I think the UK is a bit slow to catch up with that kind of behaviour. I think that's quite exciting.
I feel like you've practiced that. that was too good.
In truth, I've written about it.
Yeah,
I used to write a column in The Guardian about this sort of stuff.
Okay.
I still do occasionally.
And I'm convinced.
I'm quite passionate about it.
Yeah.
And I think it is genuinely a more exciting industry to come into with those kinds of prospects than maybe it was 20 years ago.
So talking about this idea that we're trying to help clients who are good and all that kind of thing,
yeah.
There's like a trend at the moment where clients are bringing their creativity in-house. What do you think to that?
Well, that's a very topical question as well, isn't it, with the Pepsi ad, very fresh in our minds. I think it can work, actually. I mean, the criticism levelled at Pepsi was there was no one in the approval process who was able to point out how shit this particular script was before it got anywhere near a camera, right? And because they're all employees of Pepsi, so, you know, if it's being driven by someone higher up in the hierarchy, what are you going to say? Whereas an agency, in theory, would have pointed out that this was a horrible misappropriation of, you know, society's hopes and fears, which is what it was. There are some really good examples of in-house creative.
Paddy Power comes to mind.
Well, Paddy Power is interesting. Someone, a journalist, wrote the other a couple of weeks ago that when did the betting industry decide it was funny? And it was Paddy Power who kind of made that decision. Specsavers has done some great work down the years. But the best example is Channel 4 with 4 Creative, who consistently do fantastic stuff. My favourite TV ad of the last 10 years was Superhumans for the Paralympics. I thought it was just fantastic. Just fantastic. It still makes me kind of well up when I see it now. Yeah. I've seen it 50 times. You know.
And I believe BBC have kind of created their own agency in order to try and to get some of that in-house and all.
That's true. And there are other, I mean, it's increasing. It's a lot more common than the advertising industry actually thinks and has been. And you know, a lot of big companies have had in-house design for years and years, quietly, you know, doing packaging or whatever in the background. For a long time, or probably even now, the fastest growing agency in London is called Oliver. And until a year or two, until it bought Dare, actually, no one had really heard of it. And it was putting in-house creatives, you know, implants, if you like, into client companies. That was its proposition.
Wow.
It's not all it does, but...
Going back a little bit to one of the things you mentioned earlier, you said you went to Cambridge.
I did.
So I read your bio, and it seems like you've had quite an exceptional education. Harvard Business School. For a lot of young people who are looking at the prospect of going to university, say you're an illustrator and you're likely to rack up £50,000-£60,000. Do you think they should go?
Wow. I think it's a really, really tough decision. And to a certain extent, it depends on lots of factors. It depends on what else is on offer, I think. And there are sort of hybrid degree apprenticeships in some industries where you do a fast-track degree, but you're being paid at the same time. And that seems like quite... So I'll give you an example. I've got 3 daughters, and the oldest of which is she's 26. She's very clever. She actually went to Oxford and got a fantastic degree. And she comes from, obviously, a middle-class background, you know. And she said if she had known about the stress that the debt she's incurred would cause her, she might have thought twice about it. And if that affects her in that way, then, you know, God knows how much it must affect people from less advantaged backgrounds. And I think it's a big call. And I think you might be about to ask about this, but so I might be jumping the gun here. I think it has a terrible, terrible effect on the creative industries. It makes them far less diverse, both demographically and actually, you know, ethnically, because people can't afford it. They can't afford to live in London when they leave university. But, you know, if you're from a relatively disadvantaged background, why would you even consider incurring £60,000 worth of debt? It's an unimaginable amount of money, and it's made our industry worse. Already it's in the process of making our industry worse.
Especially as there's lots of alternatives that are kind of emerging online.
There are, yeah.
And... Yeah, I speak to so many people about this, and very few people got asked where they studied or anything. It kind of came down to their work, which obviously I think university gives you time to ferment. But if you're proactive and are capable of pursuing things by yourself, which a lot of university lecturers claim that students wouldn't be had they not had been forced into some form of programme. But I agree. I think it's a massive burden for people to undertake.
If leaving the debt issue aside, which you can't, obviously, because it's enormous... Of course, 3 years at university for most people is a fantastic experience. You know, whether, you know, almost whatever you're doing, it's just time to mature and reflect. And, you know, you're a long time working as well, is the other thing, you know. So, you know, you've got 40, 45 years of it. You know, having 3, relatively speaking, slack years, I think is a good thing. It's just that people, you know, this government and its predecessors have made it very, very difficult.
So you'd already preempted my next question to some degree, which is DNAD is kind of responsible for highlighting the best creativity.
Yep.
But it's no real secret that within the ad industry that it's for years been predominantly dominated by white men. Yep. And that doesn't take into consideration all the different diverse backgrounds and all the cultural influence they have. But they can't necessarily either afford to apply for a DNAD or... even get into the agencies in the first place.
Yeah.
How as an industry, do we address this kind of problem of cultural diversity?
So I spoke actually at a Creative Equals conference last week that Ali Hanan, who founded that organization. And the first thing to say is I think ethnic diversity and demographic diversity and gender balance are all part of the same issue, but they have very different root causes, and therefore there are different solutions to them. And I don't want to, you know, it'd be boring for your listeners to go through it, all of it now. I think the gender thing is slowly being tackled. So the title of my talk was Fuck Fairness, right? Because trying to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, because it's socially just. We've seen almost no progress over the time that I've been in the business. I mean, there have been changes. It's not quite as madman as it was 40 years ago. But women are still seriously disadvantaged. You know, there are more women than blokes coming out of arts universities. I'm thinking about creative departments here, but primarily. And when you get to the top, I think less than 12% of creative directors are women. So something's going wrong. And it's a tremendous loss to the industry of all that talent and all that experience, you know, kind of effectively being prevented from returning after, you know, after having children. It's a ridiculous waste. So the fuck fairness thing was there's tons of evidence to show that companies with better gender balance at senior levels perform better than their competitors. Equally, there's tons of evidence that companies with good diversity, both sort of demographic and ethnic, perform better than their competitors. So let's not make it about social justice, because that hasn't worked. Let's make it about the business. And the reason that they perform better is that less homogenized communities produce less homogenized solutions. You get a greater diversity of problem solving and creative work, and that's a good thing. So my attitudes have changed. I was like, I kind of wanted to do the right thing, I hope, throughout my career when I was running agencies and before. But now I'm kind of passionate about that as well. I think it's so important.
Selling in the idea that the bottom line will change if you diversify.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's driving the sustainability agenda. It's profit. And in the end, it comes down to money. And if you can't make money, if you doing the right thing doesn't produce the right result commercially, it won't happen. It'll happen very, very slowly, glacially slowly.
So on the subject of that, kind of how you can change your agency model and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The traditional ad model is very, very tried and tested. You know, we win clients, you pitch, you provide ideas, blah, blah, blah. You go through this process that everyone's very familiar with. Do you feel like there's any room for innovation, or do you know of any agencies that are doing things particularly differently that are getting kind of cut through?
That's a really interesting question. That's a lot of...
But like even for example, I wonder if are creative teams obsolete?
I don't think teams are obsolete. I think that the traditional copywriter art director, you know, team might be on its way out the exit door. So here's the thing. I'm going to say something controversial, which may, why not?
Brilliant. That's what, that's what I'm after, Tim.
I think in 5 to 10 years, advertising as we knew it won't exist. So because people will have found ways of avoiding it, I think a lot of marketing communication will have become automated. And I think that process will have... In that process, we'll have sort of commoditized creativity and craft. However, creativity and craft will remain massively important because brands will have to find other ways of engaging with their customers, people. And that's already happening. So, long-form content becomes more and more relevant each day. Experiential becomes more and more important. PR's in a very, very interesting, at an interesting nexus of... Of a whole load of things, you know, the days when they just, you know, sent out stereo, you know, photocopied press releases, long gone. So I think there are companies emerging from this that I don't really want to name names, but people like Gravity Road, Sunshine, Smarts Communicate in Belfast, and people like that are finding different ways of making that connection between goods and services.
It's actually one of my questions, which was, you know, are the traditional ads which sell you stuff feel like they're on the way out in the sense that branded content, or i.e. content you want to consume that is also branded, tends to be how things are moving.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a little another trend, which is people are less, or maybe not less so, but as well as engaging with brands, are also engaging with individuals. And even as an industry, more and more people are finding ways to sustain themselves independently outside of an agency and building a following. And how do D&AD look looking to change with the growing kind of population of creatives who are able to sustain themselves independently, who oftentimes are obviously at the top of their game in order to be able to do that?
Well, funnily enough, I had a conversation with a woman this afternoon who's an accomplished creative. You know, she's quite experienced, and she's starting up a magazine as a sideline, and which has relevance for our Shift program, which maybe we can talk about later. So what do we do? Well, we kind of try and support those things, in truth. So, you know, we'll lend our media platform, social media, you know, to promote them. You know, we'll give them exposure and airtime and support and where we can. And I would like us to have that reputation, you know, reputation that you can come to D&AD if you need something. You know, you need a bit of a helping hand and a shove in the right direction.
Great. There's a little bit of a trend going on. Particularly in fashion at the moment, where there's this kind of re-emergence of big brand logos on clothing, which it kind of came from 90s, kind of 80s, 90s, yeah. And I mean, being slightly older than myself, I mean, this is the first time I've really seen like a full-scale re-emergence of design style and aesthetic. Are we lazy, or is it a case of, is there a reason for these repeats in history?
Oh, wow. I'm not a big expert in this. I used to run the Levi's account at BBH, though, back in the 80s. And so I'm interested in the whole fashion industry from back then. I think nothing comes around the same. That's the first thing. So there's no point hanging on to your old clothes, because it always comes back differently interpreted. I think, you know, cultural and social circumstances can give rise, you know, in different generations to similar things. I hadn't noticed this particular trend until you pointed it out. I mean, certainly in my 40 years in the business, I haven't seen anything come around, you know, in recognisably the same form, I don't think. It's interesting you perceive it in fashion. I think fashion is quite cyclical, isn't it? I don't think advertising fashion is particularly cyclical.
Well, it's funny. So I've noticed a bunch of posters being produced where it's basically like a montage of imagery that's been seen together in Photoshop, and that was what I was doing at college.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, that's interesting that there's a little bit of that coming back. I'd be interested to see if grunge reemerges, which was really popular when
it would. Someone said to me that to a, you know, 22-year-old, letterpress is new media. So there you go, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of what the kind of whole hipster movement is about. You know, you know, trying to be serious about it for a moment, it is about authenticity, isn't it? Authentic experiences.
Yeah.
You know, some of which are, you know, media orientated.
Last question on the serious questions, and then I'll get into more fun stuff. So people kind of point to the 60s as a time of creative revolution and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think we're in the midst of a new revolution, or with the emergence of digital technology, or do you think it's yet to come? Or, what's your standpoint on where we're at right now?
I do think we're in the middle of something quite significant, and where we're going to will be significantly different from where we're coming from, if that makes sense. And I think you're absolutely right about the 60s. D&AD was founded in 1962. By a bunch of actually designers initially, and then photographers, and then, as sometimes happens, a lot of advertising people joined in because it looked like it was going to be fun. And it was they were all men, as it happens, because it was the 60s, early 60s. But they formed D&AD because they wanted to attach their names to the work they were doing, and there was no way of doing it at that time. So the first D&AD annual is an exhibition guide, a 16-page exhibition guide. But there was a huge amount going on, as you just pointed out, in, you know, music, in fashion, in politics, in sexual politics, in, I mean, in art and literature, it was an explosion. And, you know, the decade changed everything. And I think we are in that period right now. I think we're living in certain times. You know, it's a sort of cliche to say that right now. But I think, actually, this is perhaps a slightly oblique way of answering your question. I think we'll look back in advertising on the 40 years between about 1960 and 2000, 2005, and it'll look like a complete aberration in terms of how, you know, human beings try to communicate with other human beings in that kind of whole interruptive mode. And that's definitely going. I mean, I said earlier, 5 or 10 years, advertising as we knew it won't exist.
In that era, there was a bunch of kind of figureheads.
Yep.
You know, in the UK, it would be John Hegarty and you know...
Saatchi's.
The Saatchi's.
Yeah.
When, obviously, there was a bunch of people involved in that time. Do you think the same will happen this time around, where key figures will emerge?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a mistake, just because everyone's now younger than you, to assume that there aren't big personalities involved in the business. I think there are some big personalities. I don't necessarily think they'll be in advertising agencies, I have to say. I think they're more likely to be in technology companies and startups and media companies. You know, you think of, you know, Vice, you think of the obvious, you know, the usual suspects, Google, Twitter, Facebook and so on. But, you know, I mean, Vice is an enormously influential organisation now. Having grown from a biker magazine, you know, Canadian biker magazine, I mean, it's on, you know.
You bring up an interesting point, which is, so I've always looked at, I think that our generation's in this funny space whereby when I was growing up, I was introduced to a computer at kind of a turning point when they started to become prominent. And then I found that actually I was better qualified for what was coming than people that were a few years older than me.
Definitely.
And so The there was a power shift where it wasn't about the old teaching the young were teaching the old. But then for the creative industry, they've got this problem whereby tech companies are offering stock options and really interesting stuff for extremely talented creatives.
Yeah.
You know, advertising doesn't work like that. So it would make sense for a really good creative to work in the tech industry, which is the booming sector, right?
That's happening, Ricky. I mean, In some things, like this being one of them, the States is kind of, you know, 3 to 5 years in our future. And there's this enormous talent drain. It's not actually a drain. It's people not going anywhere near advertising agencies because they want to work, you know, they want to work in Silicon Valley or, you know, in a tech company for all the reasons you say. But it's not just the money and the stock options. It's the prestige and the fulfillment. You know, the fact that you're expected to have some purpose in your professional life. The fact that you think you're doing good stuff, our deputy president Steve Vranakis, who's going to be president of DNAD next year, is a really, really talented advertising creative who now works for Google. And as an example, actually, of his ability to put his skills to good use, he's Greek ancestry, and has spent quite a lot of his time on Lesbos helping refugees, and Google built an app for incoming refugees to, you know, give them all the kind of, in sort of 6 or 7 languages, give them all the information that they could, you know, usefully have about how to, you know, improve their circumstances, essentially, having landed from Turkey. So he's a very pertinent example, Steve, of talent moving out of our industry and into a different one.
So as you've kind of pulled out an individual, I had a question which was, could you name 1 to 3 people within your career who have you've admired them for their creativity and who you could point to in some respect?
Yes, I can name people. So I was fortunate enough to work at BBH from its beginnings. I worked there for 9 years. And John Hegarty and Nigel Bogle were both huge influences on me. I learned enormously from both of them. Nigel Bogle's, I'm an account guy, you know, and Nigel is, you know, the sort of the account man to end all account men. He was brilliant, single-minded, very clever and determined. And I learned a lot from him. We didn't always get on perfectly. We had a few rows, actually, but he was fantastic. Hegarty, again, super single-minded and determined and clever and great taste, and produced some wonderful, wonderful work and some complete, garbage, it has to be said. He would admit that as well. I'm not even going to name names there, but occasionally didn't always work out. But if you don't, if you don't push the boundaries and all that. And then I worked for 12 years altogether for a man called Frank Lowe, who's also an account guy, actually. But he previously run CDP as managing director in the 70s, which was the best agency in the world by miles. I mean, TV, print, everything. It was fantastic. And the work they did still looks good today. And actually, a commercial they made for Benson & Hedges cigarettes, a cinema commercial called Swimming Pool, was what actually made me think actually advertising looks up.
For a cigarette brand?
Yeah, it was a cigarette brand back in the day. Look it up on YouTube. It's still amazing.
What's it called?
It's called Swimming Pool. It's got iguanas in it. It's shot by Hugh Hudson. It's brilliant. Still brilliant.
So for anyone that's listening to this via my website, you'll actually be able to click on these and watch them as we're chatting.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Fantastic. But then Frank founded Lohanspring, and I worked there briefly when it started, then went to BBH, and then came back as CEO, and eventually I was president of the Worldwide Network. And Frank, who as a human being could be difficult sometimes, was a fantastic, fantastic advertising guy. I mean, really brilliant.
If you had to pick sides of that era, like which was your favourite agency to work at?
It's really difficult. BBH was fantastic because we created the best agency in London, and there was a bunch of us doing it. Obviously, BB&H were extremely influential, but it was more than just them, which, to read John Hagerty's book, would surprise some people. Lowe's was also... The reason Lohanspring was a great agency, and it was a great agency before I got there, trust me, was because it did its best work on its biggest clients. So for Heineken and Stella Artois, Tesco, Smirnoff, Vauxhall. I mean, this was stuff that people saw, this was stuff coming into people's living rooms every evening, and they'd enjoy it because it was intelligent and well-made and funny quite often.
If you had to work for any agency in the UK today, who would you go and work for?
Oh, my God.
And you're not allowed to you're not allowed to say the gate. You're not allowed.
No, that's probably true. I like Lucky Generals a lot, and they actually are DNAD's agency, and they do some work for us. They if I had to choose one, it would probably be them. I really like Mother. I really like Wieden & Kennedy. It would be one of those agencies still desperately trying to do the best stuff, whatever the circumstances, whatever the client. I think that's you have to try to be like that. And there are a lot of agencies with good credit reputations who don't. They kind of make decisions about certain accounts that they'll just kind of turn the handle on the machine and do it for the money. And I just don't think you can do that. I think if you want to be a really, really great agency, you can't have clients like that. Because it actually is quite destructive of the culture, because some people have to work on that business.
I've literally only got a few more questions for you. Okay. So what's something that you've learned either throughout your career or just in life in general that's kind of changed your life forever? Big question.
This is going to sound completely contradictory because I've been rabbiting away, for however long it is now. But Jeff Hadspink, the Hadspink of Lohanspink, actually did say to me, nature gave you... two ears and one mouth, and you should use them in that ratio. And he meant not just professionally, but kind of in life. And I think that's quite good. I mean, it sounds trivial, but actually it's sort of, if you actually sit and properly listen to people, I think it's a great way of engaging with people. It's a great way of learning stuff. It gives you time to think yourself. A sort of version of that these days is that there are quite a lot of people who can type faster than they can think these days. Have you noticed that? So depressing when you get those long emails. You thought, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be a good experience. So I think that's good advice. And that I've tried to take that to heart. The real answer to that, though, having given myself time to think, there's a a book by a bloke called Jim Collins called Good to Great, which, like all business books, you know, quite quickly goes out of date. But it has a fantastic chapter on leadership, which is still great. And basically what he says is that the best CEOs completely subordinate their egos to the needs of the company. So they're prepared to give other people the credit. They're extremely determined, but that determination is not sort of expressed in the form of ego. It's quite the opposite. Is expressed in the form of ambitions for the company. And another aspect of that is absolutely surrounding yourself with the right people. So I really recommend the chapter, actually. Jim Collins, Good to Great.
I think I've actually read it.
It's the one business book that people should read, actually. Most business books are shit. You know, it's one half good idea repeated 10 times to make it a book. And the Jim Collins book, although, as I say, quite a lot of the examples are now out of date and it's kind of written in a pre-internet age, there are some fantastic things in it.
You stole my next question, which was you said that you'd like to read books. And so I was going to ask which some that you would recommend. Are there any others?
Yeah, advertising stuff. There's a very funny book by a guy called Jerry Dadafemina, who had his own agency called, I think it's called From Those Wonderful People Who Brought You Pearl Harbor. It's just funny, about advertising in the 60s. There's a good book by a guy called, quite a sort of spiky guy called Steve Harrison, about an American ad man called Howard Luck Gossage. The title of that book is called The Only Fit Work for a Grown Man is Saving the World. And this guy was working in the 50s and 60s in San Francisco, which was a complete backwater then, in advertising terms. Sort of prefigured a lot of internet stuff and cause-related stuff. So he named Friends of the Earth, for instance. He ran the Summer of Love from his agency, which is called the Firehouse. He's a very, very interesting guy. And a lot can be learned, you know, for today from then. In fact, I asked Chuck Porter this question, and he confirmed that this was true, that Crispin Porter Bogusky, when they were really, really rocking, had a sort of point in their development process when they asked themselves, what would Howard say at this point, which I think is great. And Chuck said it was true. So that's a good book. And another good book is, if you're interested in the history of advertising, the David Ogilvy book, Confessions of a Madman, is good. But there's a book by Andrew Cracknell called The Real Mad Men. And in response to the Mad Men series, a lot of American advertising people who'd been around in the 60s hated it because they thought the series, which we all loved, obviously, misrepresented the advertising business at that time and didn't pay anything like enough attention to the kind of creative revolution that was going on there. So Andrew went and interviewed the survivors from that time, people like Helmut Krohn and so on. And it's good. It's a really interesting record of that time, which was important in the kind of history of advertising.
We've given everyone a good reading list there to be cracking on with.
Yeah.
I think on the subject of people that could do the advice, one question I failed to ask you earlier was, you mentioned it's increasingly difficult for young creatives to break into the industry.
Yep.
What's... do you have any advice for them that would be, you know, how to make themselves stand out in an extremely saturated market?
Oh, no. Oh, God, it is difficult. And so one thing I meant to mention and didn't is that DNAD is trialling a new program called Shift, which is aimed absolutely at creatively talented people who aren't making a living from that talent as things stand. And it's a night school for those people. The only two qualifications are that you should have that talent and you shouldn't have an arts degree or any kind of degree. So we trialled it last year. We kind of went out looking in all kinds of odd creative communities. I mean, music and street art and fashion and blogging and vlogging and so on. And from a pool of about 300, we identified 30. We held an exhibition. And we were going to take 15 through the program. In the end, we selected 18. One woman had to drop out for childcare issues. There you go. And the reason it was a night school was so that people didn't have to give their day jobs up before they, you know, at least had some indication of whether their talent could kind of take them into the industry. So seven went have now got jobs and placements, and two went back into further education. And I think for all of them, it was kind of life-changing. And so we're going to run it again here. It was an extremely diverse group, and there were more women than blokes. And we've just launched it in New York.
So is it costly?
It's free.
No way. It's free.
And we couldn't do it without the support of the industry because, you know, they provide the spaces, they provide the teaching and the mentoring. And the, it's quite tough, the sort of pastoral care that you need to have available for these guys and girls is considerable because they come from this wide diversity of backgrounds and then they have no real idea what to expect. So it's a delicate job managing that whole process, but we're doing it. So getting on one of those will be good. But, you know, we've got limited resources and we can't make that widely available. Our plan longer term is to have a sort of digital campus of MOOCs, massive open online courses, that will help people skill themselves up and give them a crack at getting into the industry. But we're probably a year or two away from that at the moment. But that's the plan. We want to intervene both earlier, when people are making decisions about, you know, what exams to take, and on a much wider basis as well.
So a kind of Skillshare, yeah, esque type thing, masterclass.com, have you?
Yeah, almost a sort of, not quite Open University, but that kind of concept, I suppose.
So I was going to ask if you've got any projects on the go. Is that the one that you particularly wanted to highlight, or are there any others?
Shift is something that is very, very important. Shift will affect our whole New Blood program, because the New Blood program, admirable though it is, focuses on our, you know, arts universities. And if we're honest with ourselves, we're probably identifying those people who would probably get jobs anyway and helping them get jobs. I'm not sure if that's the greatest service to mankind. That, you know, we do a lot of other things as well, but that's another thing that we've launched recently that I'm very proud of is TNAD Impact, which we launched in the States in partnership with Advertising Week last September. And it's the white pencil part of DNAD broken off and given its own stage, literally. So we've tried to turn it into a different kind of award show. It's for stuff, for great ideas that have had a real impact, you know, in people's lives.
It's why you get into advertising.
Yeah, coming back to what we were talking about earlier. And the projects that were entered were, many of them, fantastic. So we've introduced this time around on for Impact a beta category in each of the 12 categories, because there was some stuff there that had this huge potential to, you know, impact people's lives positively, but which actually hadn't happened yet because it hadn't been funded. And we have an interface between the kind of investment community and these projects. Which
so what's one great example?
Lifesaver Backpack is a great example. It's a backpack that is also a flotation device, because in a lot of countries, Colombia is where this was invented, literally thousands of school kids drown because they go to school on rivers. And Lord Putnam was one of the jury presidents, and he said this could be one of the most important things because, you know, global warming is going to mean the sea rises, and in places like Bangladesh, that is, you know, that is, and the Maldives, obviously, that is the difference between life and death, and this could save...
Or immigrants on boats...
All immigrants on boats, exactly. But the unit price was too high for it to be, you know, scalable. But the more you make, the lower the price. And David was very, very interested in that. Another great example. Sorry.
No, crack on.
One of the best things, I think, for projects for the last 2 years was Intermarché Glorious Fruits and Vegetables. So it's sort of disfigured fruits and vegetables, literally being sold 20% cheaper in supermarkets and being turned into soups and yogurts. And so it stops food waste, right? Because all this stuff just gets thrown away. The supermarket makes money. You know, people get nutrition that they need, you know, one of their 5 a day, 10 a day now it's meant to be, cheaper. I mean, it's just a brilliant idea, beautifully executed as it happens by Marcel, the agency in Paris. And it's been picked up by 15, 20 supermarket chains around the world. I mean, that is genuinely game-changing, that.
So we want more people doing that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. That's such a great example because literally everyone gets a balloon. Suppliers, the supermarkets, and the consumer. It's just great. I love that.
Tim, I've got one more question for you, but before I do, where can people find out, well, where can people kind of follow you so they can see what you're up to and that kind of stuff?
Oh, my God. Well, I'm on Twitter and Instagram.
And what's your handle?
My Twitter handle is Timothy Thomas Lindsay, and Timothy Lindsay on Instagram. Facebook I use differently, you know, it's generally friends and family. I don't put anything very interesting on there. And I'm on LinkedIn, where I've started to post more articles and stuff I like. So those three things, probably.
Wicked. And final question. This is where you get to drop your pearls of wisdom or something that's going to... one piece of meaningful advice that would... here we go. Let me read it. If you could give the world one piece of meaningful advice to live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be? It's like a Cilla Black blind date question.
I think the secret to a happy existence is finding something you really, really like doing and then finding a way of making money out of it, making a living out of it. And I think if I was giving advice to my younger self, it would be don't chase the money, or certainly don't get trapped by the money. I mean, I don't think I'd have necessarily done anything different, but I do regret not starting my own agency. And it was purely because I didn't think, you know, I could walk away from a ridiculous, well, at that time, and now actually, it seemed to be a ridiculous salary. So I think you have to follow your heart occasionally. And I think in our business, that sometimes means turning your back on money in order to do something that's more satisfying, that, you know, gives you more satisfaction. That's a slightly garbled reply, but...
I know this seems like a you know, horribly... Not cliche is the wrong word, kind of gooey question to ask, but this within our industry, kind of anxiety and stress and all these things run rampant. And so I think it's a valuable question to ask. And I think you answered it perfectly. Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
No worries. I hope people that have listened, I hope people listen in and, take
we'll
away
see.
From it. I'm sure they will.
Okay, good.
Nice one. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.